Once you determine the genre of the little passage you're looking at, the next step is to compare with other examples of that same genre from the Bible and from outside the Bible, from that same cultural world. How is this genre used? And form criticism, the way Gunkel developed it, doesn't look so much at the content. It's not like the details of the content. It's more about the form that it takes. And what Gunkel demonstrated is that there is a set form for each genre, which is understandable, I think, for us. There's a form for a joke. If someone starts, knock, knock, I don't know, is that, you have knock, knock jokes in Estonian? No? Okay, in English, this is a classic, stupid, little childish way to start a joke. Knock, knock, who's there? And then they say something funny, or they make some little, in anyways, joke very often has a certain form, or a fairy tale. In English, the classic fairy tale beginning is once upon a time. And as soon as you start once upon a time, the person knows it's a fairy tale. Seminary essays have a certain form, appa. Newspaper articles also have a certain form. It's a style of putting it together, the text together, that's different from a fairy tale. And so you instantly know what you're reading, hopefully. So every different genre has a certain form, and that then helps us understand what's happening. So if you know what genre your passage is, then you know kind of what to expect. You know that it probably will have these characteristics. And if it does, okay, it does. But if it doesn't, maybe it'll do something different. It'll make a twist in your expectations. And that's significant. Why did the author choose to change the form? Usually it would be like this, but now it goes like that. There's a change in expectations. You know what's normal, and now there's something different. Why is it different? That helps you understand what's going on. So what is the genre? Helps you understand the meaning of the text. Is the meaning of the passage, the intention of the passage, is it about history? Is it about telling a story? Or is it theology? Is it about the event or is it about the teaching? What's most important? Different genres, different. If it's history, it's one thing. If it's a parable, it's something else. The parable is a very good example. It's a specific genre that has a specific form. You have kind of expectations of what a parable is like. And you know how it's used. You know what the point is. The point is, what's the teaching? It's not a story about a real person. It's not about an event, a specific individual. A parable is teaching a theological message. So it's a very simple example of what Gunkel is trying to do. So determine the genre, how it's used, and then determine the setting. The setting in which it was composed, its original setting. Because the setting affects the way we interpret the text. Give you, for example, an Estonian text written either in 1920 or 1950 or 1990? Does the historical setting affect the way you will interpret the text? Absolutely. Recognizing if it was written during Estonian independence in the 1920s, during Stalin, Khrushchev time, or after the fall of the Soviet Union, I mean, that's a huge change. And the way you interpret that text will be radically different based on the setting in which it was originally written. So the historical setting is relevant. But Gunkel doesn't only look at the historical setting of when. He developed something that in German is called Sitz im Leben. And this is a German phrase you need to know, because from now on, I'll just use it in German. And it's very often used in German in other languages as well. Sitz im Leben literally means the situation in life. It's not so much about the historical is part of it, when, but it's about like the sociological, where does it fit in society? Where was this used in society? Is this particular passage that you're looking at in the Bible? Is this something that was used in the Temple of Solomon as part of a grand, beautiful, big public ritual in the temple? Or is this passage something that was used in the home for teaching children? Do you see the difference? I mean, the difference between a big public event in the temple and something private in the home teaching your children. Recognizing the different setting in which it was set will radically affect the way you understand it. Where does it fit in society? That's what Sitz im Leben looks at. How is it used? What's the intention? What was the author trying to accomplish with this text? So, for example, Joshua chapter 24. Joshua 24 is a covenant renewal ceremony. It's at the end of Joshua's life. He calls the people together and he has a public ceremony where all the nation renew the covenant they made with God. It's a very formal event. And Joshua 24, then it follows a certain pattern. There's a certain style of how things function. What happens if you're reading somewhere else in the Bible, maybe in the prophets, and you read something that, you know, that really reminds me of Joshua 24. I mean, the content is different, but the style is very similar. And we know that Joshua 24 was this public national event, this national ceremony. If you see a similar pattern somewhere in the prophets, then you can ask the question, is that what the prophet is trying to push here? And maybe he did. Maybe there was a public ceremony where the people came back and all gathered together and said, we will be faithful to God. Intentionally copying the form, well, it might be intentional. And it tells you something about how it was used, what was expected, what was going on, how we should understand it. So Sitz im Leben is a very, in some ways simple, in some ways very complicated, but very useful idea. What is the historical and the sociological setting? The setting in history and the setting in society for this text. And Sitzenleben tries to be smart. I mean, that's a good thing. And says, don't look just at what the text claims, but look at the little clues within the text that can tell you the real setting. Let's say, for example, just to give illustration what I mean, you're reading an Estonian text. And it's a history, it's an event, it's describing a war. It's describing the war between Estonians and the German crusaders that were coming in 800 years ago. Okay, it's describing that event, that period of history. And it's describing this battle, and the main character is Lembit, and in the middle of the battle, Lembit pulls out a gun and starts shooting the Germans. What is the Sitzimleben of that text? It claims to be telling the story from the 13th century. That's what it claims. Is that the real Sitzimleben? What? You think they did not have guns, right? They did not have guns, exactly. Very obvious example. 800 years ago, they did not have guns. So as soon as you see that he pulls out a gun and starts shooting the Germans, you know that the real setting of this story is much more modern. It's not original from the time of 800 years ago. Exactly. And so recognizing what is the real setting, not necessarily what is claimed. That's what Sitzimleben is looking at. So here's another example. Here is something. Many a man's body. Okay, by the way, okay, let me explain this. I'm going to give you two texts. Very short texts. Both of them claim to be telling the story of the same war. Okay, they claim it's the same war, same event, same people, basically. What is the Sitzimleben? What is the setting of these texts? First one. Many a man's body was wounded with the pitiless bronze as he turned round and bared his back to the foe. It's not from the Bible, but okay, there's the first one. Here's the second one. Same war, different text. But Rhoetus, wakeful and observing all, behind a spacious jar he slinked for fear. The fatal iron found and reached him there. For as he rose, it pierced his naked side. So I don't know if you like war stories. Maybe you don't, but. Okay. Two stories, two different stories, claiming to tell the same war. Do they have the same Sitzimleben? What is the setting? The real setting of these texts, not the story, the texts. They claim to be telling the same about the same war. Are they? Anyone notice anything? Sitzimleben says, look at the subtle little details, the little details that are mentioned. Are they describing the same war?
Hello.
Yeah, Indrek.
It's iron and bronze.
Exactly. No. I can't find it. Iron. Probably. I don't know what it is in Russian. You see the difference? Very little detail. What weapon are they using? What are their swords made out of? In the first one, it's bronze. In the second one, it's iron. The first one, they're both telling the story of the Trojan War. But the first one is Homer. That's the original. And Homer was written early in time. He still remembers that back then, weapons were made out of bronze. The second one is written 700 years later, during the Roman Empire. It is retelling the story of the Trojan War. But by this point, they've totally forgotten about bronze swords, because that's ancient technology now. And now the swords are made out of iron. The setting of these texts is totally different. This is written when Augustus is Caesar Augustus. It's about the Roman Empire. It's set during that time. It's talking about the Roman Empire, actually. That's the context of the text. This is totally different. It's centuries earlier. It's a totally different context, totally different setting. They claim to be telling the same war, the same story, but the setting underneath, that's what Sitz im Leben really looks at, because that's where we really understand the motivation of the author. What is he trying to communicate? What's his message? That's what matters for Sitz im Leben. So another example, Bible example. Matthew chapter 23 is a chapter full of woe to the Pharisees. Jesus is condemning the Pharisees. The Pharisees are snakes. The Pharisees are like a tomb. What's the Sitz im Leben of Matthew? All the Gospels have a conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees, right? That's in all of the Gospels. But Matthew has it the strongest. Matthew has, it's a whole chapter, and he says nasty things about the Pharisees. It's not polite. He's really hard on the Pharisees. Why? And I'm not talking about Jesus right now. I'm talking about why is Matthew's gospel emphasizing this, whereas Luke doesn't. It's there. The conflict is there. But it's not emphasized the same way. Matthew is the one who really emphasizes Jesus' opinion about the Pharisees. Why? What is the Sitz im Leben? What is the setting in the life of the author and the readers? Who is Matthew written to? Jews. Who is Luke written to, written by? A Gentile. Yeah. Luke is written by a Gentile, for a Gentile, probably. Theophilus. It's a Greek name. Matthew is written by a Jew for Jews. So why does Matthew emphasize this conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees, but Luke doesn't? It's there, but Luke doesn't really emphasize it the same way. Why? Speculate. Just think. what would be a logical explanation? Why does the Holy Spirit think? No, sorry. The Holy Spirit doesn't think. He knows. The Holy Spirit knows Matthew is writing to these people. Luke is writing to those people. And so the Holy Spirit inspires them to write differently. Matthew's writing to Jews. What was the opinion of the Jewish religious leaders, society leaders? What was their opinion about Jesus? Did they like Jesus? Not very much. No, they did not like Jesus. Did they like Christians? I mean, did they like Jews becoming followers of Jesus? No. I mean, read Acts. They did not like that. So why is Matthew emphasizing Jesus's opinion about the Pharisees? What's the Sitz im Leben? The theory is, this is theory of scholars. The theory is that Matthew is writing to a specific community where the Pharisees, the Jewish religious leaders, are really persecuting the followers of Jesus, arguing with them and trying to pull them back, pull them away from Jesus, back to traditional Judaism. And so the theory is that Matthew wrote to confront that. And he intentionally is showing Jesus's attitude to the Pharisees as a way of reminding his readers, don't follow those people. Does that make sense? Luke is writing to Gentiles. Yes, there's a conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees, but it doesn't affect the life of the Gentile people very much. And so Luke does not need to emphasize that. Luke has a different Sitz im Leben, a different setting in life. Now, does that make sense? Does that make you read Matthew a little bit differently? Does it make you, when you think of that passage, Matthew chapter 23, is that going to affect or maybe help you understand what's going on? It should. I think it should. I think it should help us a lot to recognize what's going on. If we understand Matthew in terms of a real confrontation between the followers of Jesus, Jewish followers of Jesus, and Jewish, well, enemies of Jesus, the people who did not accept him as the Messiah, then that helps understand a lot about the differences between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. That can help us understand the message that he's giving. This is Sitz im Leben. This is exactly what Gunkel was developing. And I think it has a lot of helpful ideas to it. So, okay, just give another example. Any of the epistles, think of any of the letters of Paul. Ask yourself the question, why did Paul write what he wrote? Because the Holy Spirit inspired him. Yes, I agree. I know. Definite. But why did the Holy Spirit inspire Paul to write this to the Corinthian church? What's the situation in life? The Corinthian church was dealing with certain problems. They have a certain situation. And Paul is responding to that situation. The Holy Spirit wants him to respond to that real life situation. So understanding the situation, looking at the subtle clues, what is being talked about, why and how, that can help us appreciate a lot more what's going on. So, back to form criticism. In form criticism, the author is really a compiler. He is compiling, he's collecting all these little passages and writing them down into the written sources that eventually will be woven together or edited together to create the final biblical books. So this is part of a long historical process, according to the theory. This was taken into the New Testament by a very famous New Testament scholar by the name of Rudolf Bultmann, a generation later. And what Gunkel did in the Old Testament, trying to identify the little individual passages, analyzing the genre, trying to discover the Sitz im Leben, Bultmann did the same thing in the Gospels and into the New Testament. And he cataloged all what he would call the different genres, described them, tried to figure out how they function, what's the purpose, try to understand the form and the reason each one takes the form that it does. So this is all part of a theory about how the text developed the way it did. Okay. Questions, comments? Does this feel kind of overwhelming, like a lot of information? Yeah, it kind of is. Does it make sense? Like, are you following what I'm saying? Or is there something that's not clear? You'll see in the exam. Yeah. Good answer. I was thinking about that. Last time, I briefly mentioned the syllabus and mentioned assignments. But I also told you don't start doing the assignments yet, remember? And the first assignment, there's something you need to read, book you need to read. And I told you don't start reading it until after this week. Because what you need to do when you start reading the book, you need to try to pay attention and notice, is the author of that book using some of these methods that we're talking about today? How is he using them? And is this helpful? What is good? What is not good? What do you find useful? What do you find not useful? Analyze, give your opinion on that. And so by the end of today, technically tonight, you could start reading the book if you want to, because we'll have gone through enough of these that you'll be able to do that. No comment? Okay.
Kus ta ütleb, et mitmed nagu on juba võtnud kirjutada seda ja siis ta uurimus tekstiline kirjutus on.
Yeah. Okay. The question was, with this form critical theory of development, how does this compare with what we read in the Gospel of Luke? At the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, it says many have undertaken to draw up an account of what happened to the life of Jesus, and I have carefully studied everything, and now I give you my opinion. I think on Saturday we're going to have time, we'll get to the Gospels. Because yes, you do see something of that. Luke says there are many written accounts, and Luke has obviously studied those. He doesn't exactly explain all the details, but to some extent, Luke is admitting that he has done some of this. Luke was not an eyewitness of Jesus. He lived in another country. He became a Christian. It seems like somewhere in the middle of the book of Acts, Luke hears about Jesus and appears as a follower of Jesus. So he had studied and he had written sources. Yeah, we'll get to Luke, because with Luke, with the Gospels, with Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's kind of a unique case, and we'll spend time specifically on that. But yes, there is something similar here going on. Yeah, and we'll talk about that once we've gone through here a little bit more. Any other comments, questions? The next thing we're going to do, and we'll continue after we have the worship service, we'll be downstairs. So for online people, that's a different link. And then we'll start after lunch. And after lunch, what we're going to do is we're going to go through Rudolf Bultmann's analysis of the baptism of Jesus. Now, I have no idea what the sermon is going to be about because I'm not preaching, but maybe we'll be reading Mark chapter 1, and maybe you can read that before we come, or we'll. Yeah, we're going to look at how Rudolf Bultmann uses form criticism in his study of the baptism of Jesus based on his book, Die Geschichte der Synoptischen Tradition. And if anybody cares, I'll confess that I don't speak German. I have an English translation of his book. It's called The History of the Synoptic Tradition, which is exactly, I think, what the German says. But I just gave the German because German sounds cool. Yeah, no, my wife speaks German. I don't need to. Okay, so I think we're done then for now, and we'll continue after lunch.